Today's episode is brought to you by Lynda.com. If you want to be a better photographer, they've got class on how to do that. If you want to make your website better, you can learn how at Lynda.com, whether it's learning how to code or how to do graphic design. No matter what you're looking to do, they've probably got a course on it. So go to Lynda.com/cracked today. That's LYNDA.com/cracked for a 10-day free trial. And it's also being brought to you by Squarespace. Once again, our old friends at Squarespace want you to start building your website today at squarespace.com. You can enter offer code CRACKED at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Now on to the episode. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien. I am the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and this week we're talking about stereotypes. There are the stereotypes you know to look out for because they're negative, but then there are the positive ones that we think are harmless. These type of people are good at a thing. In movies, when Kevin James wants to have sex with a woman who's comically out of his league, he'll go to Will Smith or Kevin Hart because black people are cool. There's a whole genre of movies where that's the basic premise. Elderly Asian people are magic. So are elderly black people and middle-aged black people. Everyone who's not white is basically magic. And that doesn't seem like a thing that bothered me, people believing I have magical powers. But we've covered on the site a study that found that black people are statistically given less pain medication than white people for the same injury in emergency rooms. And I don't know if that's related to the fact that white people make pop culture and seem to believe that Will Smith and Morgan Freeman are supernatural beings, or if there's some other unexamined stereotype that makes us assume that pain doesn't hurt black people as much as white people. But that's the type of thing we're talking about today. Real stereotypes that go unexamined because they sound ridiculous when you put them in words, or because they sound harmless when you say them out loud. We'll discuss a movie stereotype about people with physical disabilities you probably don't realize you've absorbed. We recently did an article with a guy whose dad and uncles all have a congenital condition that makes them blind. And one of the weirdest challenges he said that blind people are constantly facing is being accused of being fake blind. His dad worked with a coworker who would move his work belongings around his desk to try to prove he was faking it because he wasn't, I guess, constantly open palming his way around the walls of their office, shouting who turned out the lights or whatever happens in the miracle worker. And we were like, oh, okay, so maybe we should just be doing a personal experience article with your dad's coworker, who's apparently the worst person in the world. But he pointed us to some news stories that suggest that that sort of thing is actually really common. Blind people not acting blind enough for people who can see. And yeah, we'll talk about those news stories. But it's not just blind people. There's that study of lottery winners and people who have been paralyzed that says their happiness returns to about the same level after a couple of years. At first, you know, obviously the people who have been paralyzed are less happy. The lottery winners are more happy, but eventually you are as happy as you're going to be today. And the lottery thing is easy enough to believe. We've seen ambitious people get rich and powerful only to discover that, you know, building a cocaine empire or a social network doesn't fill the hole in their heart, aka there's still a woman they can't have sex with. Rooney Mara in The Social Network. Scarface, it's his sister, weirdly. But the idea that paralyzed people would return to the same level of happiness was always harder for me to believe and, like, mentally conceive of. I think I always secretly just suspected the paralyzed people were putting on a brave face or, you know, lying to the scientists, which, if I took a survey asking me how happy I was, and then I got paralyzed in a freak accident, and then that same scientist showed up in my hospital room with a survey being like, how about now? How happy are you now? I'd probably be freaked out. I'd probably tell them whatever they wanted to hear and assume they were Illuminati Time Lords or something. But I don't know how that survey worked, but I know people who work with victims of spinal cord injury who say that that study about matches up with their experience in the real world. People who had positive outlooks and a good support system in place before the injury generally end up leading happy, fulfilling lives. And I think that's been hard for me to conceive of, because in movies, being paralyzed is at least a decade-long sentence with, like, alcoholism and misery, and in the case of Million Dollar Baby, as we'll discuss, Hilary Swank's sort of plucky, upstart Lady Rocky is like, I'm paralyzed? Nah, throw in the towel, coach. And Clint Eastwood's like, hey, your call, lady. And I don't mean to deny that people with disabilities face serious obstacles, but if you're that sort of ass kicker, you'll usually overcome them in amazing ways that we don't see in movies or on TV. John Locke manipulates the events on the island in Lost to keep people trapped there, even though the island's constantly trying to murder them, because he can walk there. And, you know, he'd rather die running from the smoke monster and polar bears than live in a wheelchair. And that's totally believable based on every other physically disabled person in movies that we've ever seen. But it was offensive to paralyzed people who were like, no, man, we're good. We will not murder someone for the use of our legs. And I don't know, the fact that real disabled people find a way to persevere seems like the sort of things movies should be making up. But instead, they chose this one actually hopeful situation to pretend is hopeless. And that's weird. And I don't think we're going to fully explain why that is, but we'll be pointing out weird things like that, weird assumptions that are buried in your brain that affect how you think about the world without realizing it, based on these unexamined stereotypes. Hope you enjoy it, and I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. Came the truth. My screams is the proof. Some other dudes get the goose. So I speed in the coop, leaving this interview. It ain't nothing new. I've been fucking with you. None of them niggas ain't taking you. Just tell them to make a you, huh? That's how it be. I come first like debut, huh? So baby, when you need that, give me the word. I'm no good. I'll be bad for my baby. So we're talking about benign stereotypes, which I don't know if there's really such a thing as benign stereotypes, but I guess they're kind of unexamined stereotypes, or things that when someone says stereotypes, they're not the first things that come to mind. And just to start us off with an example, I wanted to introduce you guys. I just realized I haven't done that yet. Joining us in person with his clear, melodious voice is Jason Pargin. Hi, Jason. Good to see you with my eyes.
Hello, Jack. And I write as David Wong on the site, for those who are confused.
Yes, and one of the internet's most popular writers. And then joining us in studio as well, our old favorite Serge, Joshua Sargent,
Serge.
Also one of the most popular writers on the internet.
I think the most popular.
Yeah, we're talking about the thing that I said before, benign or unexamined stereotypes. I wanted to start off with blind people, which ties into one that Sarge has written on the site about, which is disabilities. And Sarge, in your article, you mentioned an anecdote where the TV show Dollhouse had a blind person visit the set for an episode where Elijah Dushku, I think.
Dushku? Elijah,
yeah,
Dushku?
Where she loses her sight, and they were like, not blind enough. She looks like she's getting around too well and is too, I don't know.
Yeah, Eliza Dushku was modeling this blind woman's behavior and, you know, acting, moving around the way she moved around, and the directors decided that she looked too capable and made her act clumsier and more helpless so that audiences would be, oh, okay, we believe she's blind now. It's an example where the real thing didn't look realistic, so they made her seem more helpless to conform to what people expected
right
people to be like.
You know, something I've made fun of before is Al Pacino's character in Scent of a Woman, the fact that his eyes are always opened as wide as they go, almost like he's in the middle of like one of those cartoonish takes when somebody like sees a woman with a big old butt and like rubs their eyes and then like opens them really wide to like make sure they're working. It's like, rather than being like an accurate portrayal of a blind person, he won the Oscar for being the culmination of the trope of how blind people act in Hollywood movies.
His eyes also stand out because the rest of his performance is so subdued and subtle in that movie.
Right.
I mean, to build on that and the Eliza Dushku thing, in another article we wrote about the way the modern world screws blind people.
Right. It was based on an interview with a person who was like, hey, here's something that sucks about being blind. Everyone thinks you're faking. Italy had this huge campaign where, like, Italians were just like, that's a fake blind right there. I can tell all these fake blinds going around. Like, there were, like, blind people being harassed by the Italian government because they were said to be fake blind people or faking it. Like, the way blind people use canes is not always the way that we expect them to in movies. And so they're constantly being, like, grabbed by the cops, or like one guy got tased by the cops because he thought it was a sword that the guy had. So it's just like, it seems like a really benign stereotype that blind people all are walking around tapping everything with a cane and have either dark glasses or their eyes wide open. But it's actually a thing. A lot of what we know about the world, a lot of how we understand things and how we picture things that we don't have a lot of experience with, is filled in by the movies. And that really can drastically affect the lives of people in crazy ways. Six Flags held three blind men at the gate for hours as they tried to assess the threat they posed with their canes. Yeah, it's a tough world for people who are good at being blind, because movies don't make room for that.
The end of the article, the last entry, is her saying that the biggest pain in the ass that comes with being blind isn't that I can't see, it's the way people interact with me and assume I'm helpless or assume I'm lying, and like that complicates things more.
Just constantly walking around with people like clapping in front of her face, being like, ha! You saw it, didn't you? Throwing baseballs at her.
But I think even that example, like, people know that people with disabilities have it rough. So in terms of, you're talking about like benign stereotypes. And the thing is, our relationship with stereotypes is really, really weird. Like, I think the primary discussion around this podcast or the comments are going to be about, are all stereotypes bad? Because everybody has stereotypes they think of as harmless. You know, like, we make fun on the side of, you know, hipsters always wear a certain type of hat, or they're always bringing their dogs to restaurants. Like, you don't think of that as like an ugly stereotype. So the question is, well, is there such a thing as a harmless stereotype, or are we just desperately trying to find more things to be PC about? And that's not really the point. The point is that a lot of these are sort of weird, and even the ones that are harmless are kind of presumed to be bad. And just to give a really strange example, and this is one I've asked dozens of people about this, and I've never gotten an answer to it. But when I was in college, we had a teacher, she was Japanese. She had only been in the country, I think she'd said about 6 months, teaching a class on, I don't know, literature or something. But we had in a story a piece of dialogue where a white character said to a black character something like, why don't you go home and eat your watermelon? Or something like that. Or maybe it was fried chicken. You know, one of those. And the teacher, this Japanese teacher, didn't get it. She didn't get the reference. So she asked the class, like, now what's this in reference to? What are they talking about with the watermelon thing? And what she found was that everybody in the class had heard of that stereotype. Black people love watermelon. And that no one in the class, including the black students, which was about a third of the class, no one knew where that came from or what it meant. No one knew why that was, because the people saying that slur themselves happily enjoy watermelon and fried chicken with no problem. Like, how that came to be like a derisive thing to say to someone was totally unknown. And it's the same thing if there's like a bunch of cops standing around and your friend leans out of his car and says, what, somebody drop a donut there? Or is there a donut shop you went for? Like, those are clearly like fighting words. Like, you would be mortified that he said it, even if both you and your friend are eating a donut at the moment. Like, somehow the thing that, like, telling a cop that he likes donuts is a bitter, bitter insult for reasons that no one can put their finger on. So it's this very cartoonish attribute we've given to the group that's not bad. You know, there's nothing inherently shameful about any of those three foods, But in everyone involved in the conversation, from the speaker to the listener to the third party listening, everyone knows it was intended as an insult, and everyone will take it as such. And I don't know why.
It's like delicious food-based stereotypes of like, man, you like this delicious food, you crazy person. But yeah, I mean, I'm assuming, and just doing a quick Google search, there's plenty of really racist sort of imagery from history surrounding the watermelon thing that I'm sure this is pulling its meaning from. But
and there are so many different explanations I've heard for that specific stereotype.
Oh, I spent a lot of time trying to find like the origin of it. There's a bunch of urban legends, but that's the thing. Everyone happily uses the insult. Obviously, not everyone. I mean, everyone recognizes the insult, but no one knows why it's an insult. So when you talk about any of the examples we're going to bring up on this podcast, or anything like Asians are really good at math, or even if they're like complimentary, bad people will use them as an insult and know that they'll be taken that way. And if you call them out on it, they'll act like it's no big deal. Like, well, all I said was, what do you think, Obama filled the White House with a bunch of fried chicken? What's wrong with that? Everybody loves fried chicken. It's like, you know damn well what you were saying.
I think that the donut one is the perfect example of what we're talking about here. Because I think anytime that you have a stereotype about a member that is not part of the controlling, ruling majority. So if white people are saying that, oh, they only eat these two foods, or they're especially fond of them, or they, you know, they go crazy for them, it's condescending, and it's also reductive in a way that a few months ago we did an episode about racism and things that white people don't understand about what the modern world is like for black people and people who aren't white. And I started off just like listing all these stereotypes of white people that I had never heard and were like perfectly delightful for me to read them off and like be like, oh, we do like campfires. I love campfires. And like, white people don't dress for the weather. So true. Like, you know, I wore shorts for an entire winter in college. And I think that's the point, is that the fact that I have the luxury of going through life not realizing, not having to view myself as a collection of stereotypical traits, no matter whether they're negative or positive, is sort of a luxury. And it's like we get to be above that. Whereas anytime it's a group of traits made up by the controlling majority and sort of reducing other people to that, that's like part of the power that they use to kind of make those people sort of less than human. Whereas with cops have as much power as like anyone, you know, they are as much the controlling majority as it gets, and they have guns to boot. They can legally shoot people. So why is the way that we strike back at them that, well, you love donuts? And is that true, I guess, is interesting to me.
I mean, I have multiple family members who are in law enforcement, and I've never seen any of them eat a donut, because you don't want to be seen eating one, because everyone thinks it's hilarious.
Yeah, they sneak it. It's just, if you caught them in the basement one time, it would just be just a free-for-all.
Yeah,
it's dozens and dozens of donuts.
It's, you know, it's dehumanizing in that it reduces you to, you know, your identity becomes an urge that is apparently, you know, beyond your control. It comes from the way you look, or it becomes from your profession. It's like, oh, you're not eating that watermelon because watermelons are delicious. You're eating it because you are predisposed towards it, and you can't control yourself because you're an animal. And it's how it's addressed, because no one's ever said to me, oh yeah, you know, you can't help yourself. You're making campfires and going camping all the time. You're completely bound by your urge to go do that, and no one's ever circulated pictures of, you know, white people around campfires being like, see? Yes, it's like a subtle difference that is what makes that one so nefarious, is you can't quite point, oh, right here is why it's controlling.
It's part of a larger system that I think it's difficult for me as a white dude to identify with how annoying it would be to constantly see yourself portrayed as this one thing. And there has been every single shade of white dude and cop, to be fair, portrayed on TV. Like they have exhausted the color palette of characters, of types of white guys to put on TV.
But even when the stereotype is overtly like positive, even when in many cases, because we're like trying to make up for the negative stereotype, it still has the same problem that Sarge brought up, and that it ultimately comes back to, well, you know how these people are. They're really good at math, or they're all in, they're all going to be doctors. And it's like, yeah, but it still starts you down that path of expecting someone you meet on the street to be a certain way. In other words, if you meet the Asian guy who's really bad at math, like he's now struggling against this expectation.
And it's also like there's a sort of negative space to them, too. So saying Asian guys are good at math implies something about they're not good at, that they're not cool, that they're not good at sports, that they're, you know.
And it's still a shortcut to get around thinking about them as a person.
Right.
It's like they are a trait. Now I don't need to engage them as a human being. I can be like, oh, this is... And I think that need is where I think all these positive stereotypes that we're going to talk about in this podcast kind of come from. Is it's like, oh, well, the negative stereotype is this, so we'll just switch it to a good one, and we'll paint all women as this now. So that's fine. It's like, well, no, because they're still not people. You're just painting them as this trait.
We had a really good article on the site from Christina H., and this is around when the basketball player Jeremy Lin was a national sensation. He was, you know...
Linsanity?
Yeah, and he was an Asian basketball player, and the whole country decided that that was just hilarious, that he was an Asian who was good at basketball. And you literally had, like, these headlines from the New York Post or whatever with, like, him photoshopped into a fortune cookie. Like, the New York Knicks, good fortune, get it? And, you know, she pointed out that these weren't meant to be hateful, but it feeds into that, what you were just talking about, that this thing that Asians often in movies are sort of like these very harmless sidekicks. They're always like sexless nerds, and they're always sort of awkward. And it's like the joke is how harmless they are. Like, you're not going to get beaten up by an Asian guy. And in fact, if you really want to make the audience laugh, get that nerdy Asian guy and have him talk like a rapper or a gangster, because that contrast is hilarious, right, guys? And so even there, when it was all about like almost a form of hero worship with him, it's still based on these people are ridiculous.
And it's interesting. I just heard there's this great podcast also on Earwolf called Yo, Is This Racist? That is hosted by an Asian American guy, Andrew T, who we had on that episode I was referring to. And he was saying that someone asked him why he thinks that Asian men are viewed as sort of less masculine. Why is it so shocking that an Asian guy would be player of the month in the NBA? And he was saying that it had something to do with when they brought Chinese people over to America, you know, as slaves or indentured servants or however, whatever horrible arrangement, they gave them. The only jobs they would allow them to do were things like cooking or cleaning laundry or like feminine tasks, and that it has come down from that in our culture, which was an interesting thing that I hadn't heard, but that it shows you like sort of the creepy, dark roots of something that seems as harmless as Linsanity.
Yeah, just another random example. In the 80s and 90s, which, you know, the portrayal of gay characters in movies has come a long, long way in the time that we've been alive, the people on this call. But there was this thing that I'm sure other people noticed, but in the 80s and 90s, there was this thing where in a romantic comedy, the female had to have like a gay best friend who was super wise about relationships. There's a Julia Roberts movie, I think it's called My Best Friend's Wedding. She had one of those. I think Sex and the City had a character like that. I remember it seemed like every movie had to have that. And the whole thing was that, like, because they were outside of the crazy games that men and women play with each other, they had some special insight into relationships. And so they were always there like, girl, you need to just go talk to him and tell him how you feel. And it's like they were there as the voice of reason. And these screenwriters were all like, See, there you go. There's your positive gay character in much the same way that the thing with, you know, casting Morgan Freeman as God or casting the wise black guy as... Who was the golf playing ghost that Will Smith played in that movie?
Legend of Bagger Vance.
Yeah, where he's there to give wise sage advice to the white person. Or cop shows would always have the black guy would always be the chief, you know, to rein in with the like sage advice about reining in these cops and telling them what to do. And it's like, see, we're making it up to them. We're now taking these characters and we're always making them these wise, thoughtful people without really realizing that you're still portraying them as existing outside of the life everybody else is living. It's like elevating them to another level. They're still on a different level and they're still being treated as something other than just a person.
Yeah, they're writing a character to make a point about themselves and how, oh, look at me, see, I think gay people are so great, and me, the writer, look at my portrayal of gay people, as opposed to having a character who is gay. It's like I just said, they're making a point about themselves. It's a lot like how a lot of portrayals of racism in movies are also about white people learning that racism is bad rather than people actually suffering from racism. Like, it stays very much about the normal people rather than the outsiders, like a black person or a gay person. And their experience is only there to further someone else's growth.
48 Hours is that viewed as the first black-white buddy cop movie with Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy?
If it wasn't the very first one, it has to be the first one that became a huge hit, because that's always like the landmark example I hear.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because you have an incredibly talented person, Eddie Murphy, creating this role as I'm partnering up with a white cop and telling him what's square and lame about him, and he's being racist towards me, and I'm sort of taking it and giving it right back to him. And that became a trope. And I think that's interesting because I can't pinpoint exactly who the first cool gay friend was in romantic comedies, but I think there was a really good one in that Julia Roberts movie, My Best Friend's Wedding. You know, the guy who played him gave a great performance
and
was very talented, and that took creativity. But it's like it resonated because we have a that-shaped hole in our minds, sort of like it fills the slot that we have that expectation for. And then by creating some memorable character, that then becomes just a trope. Basically, Hollywood's like, yeah, more of that. But what if he was more wealthy, so, you know, it didn't seem all angry? And the black-white buddy cop movie becomes less and less about confronting racism and more just about sort of what the Cosby Show was about, like, you know, racism's over, everybody's cool here now, and whoever the first gay best friend was becomes Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, becomes, I'm sure, something even more insulting than that. And that's got to be really difficult, because you have to work so much harder as somebody who's not part of the majority to, like, become a popular movie character, a popular movie actor. And then, like, that must feel somewhat bittersweet to have the character that you create turned into this trope that gets turned sort of against you. Like, it seems like that's a lot of what Chappelle was dealing with when he, quote, went crazy and just, like, left. And Eddie Murphy seems to have, like, had difficulty with the idea of his fame, and I don't know, it's just interesting. And probably creativity creates these archetypes, but then, like, they get formed by whatever our expectations are. And the one, Sarge, that you pointed out was that we think disabilities, like, not just the blind one, but there's a lot of movies where people who are paralyzed are like, oh god, like
their lives are unlivable.
Like, the message is that they might as well be dead. Like, movie Million Dollar Baby, like, that is the ending.
Yeah, in Million Dollar Baby, she opts to die because she's paralyzed. In Avatar, Sam Worthington's legs, he's paraplegic, and that is the only reason he decides to abandon his entire species and live as a blue cat person in space forever. That's the only reason they give. It's like, well, my legs don't work as a human, so I may as well start as an entirely new species?
Yeah, and he's flown all this way, and like his kind of, it's like a really weird thing with his, right, his brother died.
Because his brother was supposed to be inside the Avatar, and but he died, so he's taking his place. And he's like, oh yeah, I'll leave Earth. I mean, my legs don't work, so there's nothing for me here.
And we as viewers are like, oh, well, his legs don't work. So it's really more, it's
and
not
Cameron
about...
knew that, because he gave us no backstory
right.
for this guy.
Yeah, that's it. My legs don't work. Oh, God, man, how are you still alive? And it's more about what people whose legs work would think of the idea of having legs that don't work than it is about how people whose legs don't work actually get around in life. I think you pointed out, Sarge, in the article that the difficulty with which the Avatar guy goes from wheelchair to anything else is like super exaggerated.
Yeah, he tries to get out of the wheelchair and he like can't do it, and he's like falling, and it's this agonizing thing where if you've met people who, you know, are in wheelchairs all day, it's not a problem because they do it all the time. They develop upper body strength.
And I bring that up because the ones about racism that we're talking about are interesting to me, but they're also, we have a sense of what they're getting at, whereas that one is like, I guess I haven't examined what about our culture wants it to be worse than it really is to have a disability, because don't we usually like cheer for the underdog and want the person who has difficulties to succeed? Normal Hollywood movie logic would dictate that the girl in Million Dollar Baby who gets paralyzed would come back and like, you know, win the fight, or like, you know, train somebody else or do something to overcome the odds, but instead she's like,
it's an extremely strange ending for that movie.
Paralysis is the worst possible thing that can happen to you. I'd rather be dead. And everyone's like, yeah, that's true.
That's right. Those people should all die.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't...
Thank you, movie.
I mean, we're not saying that things aren't difficult for disabled people, because obviously
no,
it is.
They are, but like, there's also stories like...
The weird fetishization
Diving Bell,
of it.
Yeah, and The Diving Bell and the Butterfly is a movie about somebody who can only move one eye, and it's a true story, and they like blink out this like really amazing book in Morse code, and that is like another Hollywood art film that didn't resonate as much, I think, as Million Dollar Baby, which like won all the Oscars.
It was so brave.
Brave. But it's like, I don't know. It's just weird that I don't know why that is, why that belief, or like why that's the slot that we want filled.
Is it like sadness porn? I don't know.
Well, and in the movie The Blind Side, about the real life football player who was rescued from racism by, is that Sandra Bullock?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, finding out that guy was not actually blind, I thought was some of the worst false advertising, because it turns out he's good at football because he's a giant and he's incredibly strong. Like, I thought the whole thing was, you know, he has to deal with the fact that he's like the Daredevil. He can't see anything.
Well, and that's actually funny because
what?
The poster does look like, I could see where someone would have that. I think you're joking, Jason, but like, it has Sandra Bullock walking a giant football player along, like, this way, this way, friend. I'm going to show you the way. But that was an incredible...
It's also, the blind side is a common phrase for when you can't see in a certain direction.
But he's from the blind side of town.
That movie and Daredevil should switch titles. Because if you're a blind superhero, why would you call yourself Daredevil? It has nothing to do with... I mean, if anything, he should be called Batman, because he sees by sonar. But what, because Batman was already taken, where they couldn't call him like the human submarine or something?
That's
like
a good point. The human submarine. Oh, hello, the internet. It's me again, Jack. As you know, there's plenty of news on the internet, even some news about the internet. But what about news that exclusively explores internet life and respects your intelligence? The Daily Dot is the news outlet readers trust for original journalism about internet culture and life online.
Readers trust the Daily Dot because they still believe in real journalism. Their reporters have been known to use actual telephones to speak with sources firsthand. Unheard of. The Daily Dot's actually one of the biggest news websites that you may have never heard of. They're not bragging or anything, but the New York Observer called them NY Media's best-kept secret. And they get more monthly visitors than Vox, The Daily Beast, Politico, The New Yorker, and Drudge Report. Damn, Daily Dot! The site's organized into sections that explore the internet's passions like tech, politics, geek, lifestyle, entertainment, opinion, and then also sections that report internet life as it unfolds in the spaces where people live online, Reddit, Facebook, Pinterest, Twitter, Tumblr, and YouTube, to name just a few. And they've done a really cool thing. If you go to dailydot.com/cracked, I've actually curated a bunch of stories just for listeners of this podcast. And if you like what you see, you can obviously follow them on your social medium of choice. The Daily Dot, for internet news that respects your intelligence. Guys, building a website can be tough, and even if you do know your way around coding, creating something that looks good and works well is a time-consuming affair, whether it's for a business site, a portfolio, a restaurant, or whatever else. In this day and age, you need to be online and you need a website. Well, lucky for you, Squarespace makes it easy to build beautiful websites without breaking a sweat. They provide simple, powerful, and beautiful websites that look professionally designed regardless of your skill level, and you don't have to be good at coding. Not only does Squarespace provide you with intuitive and easy-to-use tools to create your website, Squarespace also has state-of-the-art technology powering your site to ensure security and stability. And you know you can trust Squarespace for your website needs when millions of people, literally millions, and some of the most respected brands in the world trust them too. Seriously, you can't beat how easy and simple Squarespace is, and they give you 24/7 online support and a beautiful website for only $8 a month. You can even get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the year. So really, what are you waiting for? Start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. And if you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code CRACKED to get 10% off your first purchase, and it'll show them that you listened to the Cracked podcast and that you found out about them from us. We thank Squarespace for their support of the Cracked podcast. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Because sexism is so pervasive, like, these other things are somewhat specific to since people have been making movies and living with blind people, or, you know, the specific version of racism that America has. But sexism has just been around forever. So there's like, it's a very refined thing. And kind of in looking at some
We've
of
these
assumptions.
Down, yeah.
Looking at some of the assumptions, sexist assumptions that get made, it can be weird.
I like referring to sexism as something is very refined, like we've just nailed
right.
it.
Right. Like, if sexism were a drink, it would be wine, right? Like, we've just really explored all of the intricacies of all the possibilities of sexism.
Like, you can sip it and tell if it was grown on a hillside facing the sun or not.
Right. As a species, we've got it down by now. But Sarge, you, in some of the articles that you, before you were even Sarge, the guy who works full-time for Cracked, back when you were a JF sergeant.
Just some guy.
You kind of talked about this thing where a tough, strong-willed person who has like a strong personality and is clever, if it's a male, they become the hero of the action movie. And if it's a woman, they become the first to die.
Yeah, and it's because it would I mean, the examples are everywhere. We have, obviously, Vasquez in Aliens, and every role Michelle Rodriguez has ever played where she is a woman who embodies what we consider masculine traits like ingenuity and strength and resilience. And then they die because when you have a happy ending, it's uncomfortable to have a tough woman around, I think. I think that's kind of like Aliens being the example. You have your family unit at the end, And Ripley is very matriarchal, very womanly and protective of the surrogate daughter, Newt. And then Hicks is, you know, the man. He ends up hurt and disabled, and the woman has to take over. But Vasquez doesn't fit in that family unit because she's, you know, a strong woman, and that's kind of threatening the man's, I'm the male of the household status.
You almost like get a sense of man's insecurity in with this one.
Sure.
Like, because, yeah, like with slasher films, it's like, we want all the girls to be pretty, but the girls who have sex with guys, we want the one who's like,
yeah, they gotta
saving
die.
Themselves. That's the only person who can survive.
Yeah, no, women who end up with people who aren't me, they gotta...
Yeah.
It's not okay.
It just gives this creepy impression of the male sex is like...
I remember first realizing that this happened in movies when I was reading an interview with... I've never been able to find the interview again, but I read an interview with Michelle Rodriguez where they pointed out to her, and there's a bunch where they point out like, so you die in all your movies. What is that like, because you like it or like what's going on? And she was saying, her phrasing was something like, well, yeah, I can either take the role where I get to do cool action stuff and then die, or I can just spread my legs for some twat in a romantic comedy, and the former is just way more fun. And like that was like your entire explanation.
Right. Yeah, I can have a personality and die, or I can not have a personality and just be sort of the love interest.
It's not even that they get more personality, because they are, it is still a shallow character comparatively, but it's still just they have to die every time. Like, we should list more examples than just Vasquez and Michelle Rodriguez's career. Switch in The Matrix also dies. She's like kind of an androgynous masculine woman and then gets killed by Joey Pants.
I think Vasquez is a good example. Although Ripley is pretty badass, I guess.
She is, but she's feminine. She's very feminine and she's motherly.
She's serving as the mother figure to Newt at the end of that movie, the second movie. And the same thing in Terminator 2. Like, Sarah Connor survives, but she's there to be the mother to John Connor. That's her role. See, and that's the thing, is that it's not even, like, anti-woman necessarily. It's that you've got certain slots that need filled, you know, so her, she's there to be the protector of the child in that role of the mother. But if she was just a tough woman outside of that context, there wouldn't be a need for her. She becomes a character you can get rid of, because in all of these movies, you're going to kill off a lot of characters as you go. That's part of the premise of a horror movie or a slasher movie, or, you know, even in an action movie. And I think Michelle Rodriguez, didn't she die like 4 times over the course of the Fast and Furious movies? Didn't she like keep coming back? Or don't they have like multiple females that they think they act like they're dead? Then
she's like Kenny. She dies in each movie.
Yeah.
And then it's just inexplicably back.
So it's, I think it's hard. I don't want the listeners to come away with the wrong impression that it's like writers are sitting down saying, okay, this is a strong woman, so she needs to die. We need to punish her for that. It's that they insert this character and then somewhere around the second act realize they have nothing else for this person to do. So then it becomes someone who can die to give the hero it to raise the stakes in the story. You know, and so Michelle Rodriguez dying in Fast and Furious, that motivates, I don't know any of these characters' names, that motivates Frankie and Otto and Stinky to go on and try to avenge her death. They weren't trying to make some big statement about feminism or strong women or anything. None of the 27 screenwriters who have all written the same fate for her characters, none of them thought they were doing this. But like in Avatar, she almost dies like off screen. Like, she plays a pivotal role in like in the finale, like in freeing the good guys from the brig. And then she just dies in the battle, and it's like unceremonious because it's like James Cameron's like, okay, we're done with her now.
She doesn't even look sad. It's the weirdest scene because she's just like, all right, well, good luck, guys. Yeah. I'm out. And then her plane explodes.
And here's where I die. Bye. I do think the guys who are writing Friday the 13th part 7 know that there's a rule that the girl who survives needs to be the virgin and not
absolutely
have withheld sex up to that point,
because they're preying on the fear that we're going to be punished for having sex. Like, and that's what they're trying to tap into. Teenagers told not to have sex, and they want to tap into that to
but
get
it's
their
interesting to me
scarier.
that is something that I don't think we should just breeze past, the revelation that the women must remain virgins thing that we associate with religious fundamentalism. Like, we had a personal experience pitch today about someone who lives in a family who is constantly scared of being, what's it called, faith killed?
Honor killed
by her family because she has had a boyfriend. She's, you know, in her late 20s. And the movies that assume that are aimed at, like, adolescent males in America, which is, like, why do adolescent males in America have the same sort of nascent sexual fantasies as religious fundamentalism? It's interesting how universal that is.
Yeah, I think they actually are having a similar, it's distinct, their fear. But I do think it's interesting how the way the writers approach putting together this horror film is so different from what the result is, because they're just thinking, I want to make a scary movie. I got to tap into something that I know my audience is already kind of nervous about, so I'm going to go with being punished for having sex. Like, I don't know for sure if that's the approach, but that's how those movies always seems to me.
But the person punishing them is a big, strong male monster.
Oh, yeah, but...
with dick-shaped...
well, like in Alien, the alien is
well, Alien is like definitely counter this,
but it's still like it's tapping into a fear that men had about homosexuality at the time, male rape, pregnancy is forcing this anxiety kind of to come out. And I always thought that was what slasher films were also doing, is like that's what their approach was. It's like, oh, let's make young men and young women, because I think women are an audience for horror films, teenage girls.
Oh, maybe.
Not? And it's just like, oh yeah, you've heard that having sex will kill you, STDs or whatever. Here it is, a physical manifestation of those fears that's enacting them upon you with a machete, somewhat implausibly as the franchises move forward, but still, you're scared of the consequences of having sex. Here they are. But what ends up happening is that, you know, that anxiety is linked to women feeling ashamed of having sex or feeling like they've devalued themselves by having sex, and then that ends up cycling back and making that thing worse.
And it's just interesting. Yeah, sex is a scary thing, and it's a big responsibility that they're suddenly having to deal with as teenagers, and it makes sense that it would be an anxiety that would need to be addressed. But it's interesting that the way that we approach that ends up being a morality that is the same morality that that girl in the fundamentalist family has. It, like, if you have sex, you're killed.
Yeah.
And I think that was mostly the 80s. I don't know that that's still the case.
Kirby Dick talked about this. He made a documentary called This Film Is Not Yet Rated and interviewed a ton of directors. And very consistently, the MPAA will be harsher on a sex scene in which a woman enjoys herself than they will on a rape scene or a scene in which a woman does not enjoy herself. And they don't explain why, because the way the MPAA works is very strange and sort of censorious, if that's a word it is now. But they'll consistently, without any explanation, say, no, that girl's enjoying herself too much, so we need to cut away to something else. But it's fine to just, you know, execute people on screen or anything.
And that feels like the subject of an entirely different podcast, right? Like censorship double standards, because I'm trying to figure out, like, what's the harmless stereotype that's reinforcing? Like, what's the result of that? Or what's the...
Well, I think women enjoying sex is not something that people really would think about there being a fear or, like, something that males don't want to see. You'd think males do want to see that, right? I feel like there's a bunch of these that we haven't really covered, but like sort of unexamined. Like we've talked about how the EPA is like always the fucking villain, and like Ghostbusters like treats the Environmental Protection Agency as like the worst assholes in the world, and that's kind of consistent across a lot of movies. Jason, you have one?
There's a few. You mentioned the APA thing. We also mentioned in an article that in kids' movies, animal control, people taking a dog to the pound are always the villains because they're going to kidnap the dog and murder it. There's dozens and dozens of movies. Like, I swear in the 80s, like every movie that, you know, had a dog as a hero or whatever, like they were always running from the dog catcher, when in reality, you know, these people are trying to save animals that are running wild and breeding out of control. And, you know, there are a lot of times they're trying to get them adopted. And it's such a weird stereotype to put out there. And it's just kind of thoughtless. Or that orphanages are always like horrible places where the people who run them are all tyrants and they're mean to the kids. And it's like, well, Jesus, they were trying to help these kids that had no parents, that, you know, they had like nowhere to go. But in movies, there was one after another where this is like,
it's just a living hell. The kid's trying to escape from there.
Then that's making it terrifying for kids actually in the orphanages or who have are in a situation where that might be in their future because they're imagining.
Yeah, just because it makes a convenient villain. But then the one in the last 10 years or so that's become pervasive in pop culture is the concept that smart people are dicks.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, like Dr. House and like Sherlock Holmes and to a lesser degree, Tony Stark. Like if you're a genius, you're also sarcastic and biting and dismissive and you're very arrogant. And also, your genius doesn't come by a lot of hard work and study. You just naturally know everything. You can walk into a room and the information just flies into your brain. And it's not due to relentless, you know, studying and just getting really good at it. It's just you have these sudden revelations. You'll be in a conversation with somebody and suddenly everything will fall together. And like music will play and you'll stare off into the middle distance as you suddenly realize what disease this person has or who killed this person. And you're so many steps ahead of everybody else that, you know, you just can't, you don't need other people. And then there's always like all these plots about you finally like trying to connect to another human being, but it's difficult because you're so smart that you just can't stand other people. And that seems fairly recent to me. I mean, I'm sure there's examples that go back forever in pop culture, but it seems like it's only been recent that every smart person is a dick. And we're not sitting here trying to start a charity campaign or a hashtag to please save the smart people characters on TV from being portrayed as dicks. It's always, always helpful to stop and ask, why do we like seeing them portrayed this way? Why is this always such a hit with audiences? When did we decide that it's funny to see them act this way or it's satisfying to see them act this way? And I don't totally know.
Yeah, it's in the original Sherlock Holmes stories, Watson was like the fumbling, not socially well-adjusted person necessarily. Like the other characters in the Sherlock stories would rather have Sherlock at a party than Watson. And then like when we update Sherlock, Sherlock has to be this like complete social moron who is like really mean to everybody. And then like Watson is, you know, well-adjusted and can have feelings for
charming
somebody.
Martin Freeman type.
Yeah.
My favorite example of what Jason was just talking about is in the Avengers when Tony Stark walks in and says all these science words, and then they say, oh, well, when did you become an expert in whatever the science is? And he goes, oh, last night. And we not only do we never get a shot of him reading a book at any point in this entire franchise, but we find out right there that he can become an expert in something in an evening. So he hasn't even worked very hard to get what he has because he has his brain works in such a way that it's impossible for him to not learn and understand things better than other people. So there's no hard work at all in Tony Stark's life.
And he can become the world's foremost expert in a subject. What was it, biology or something?
Whatever makes the Hulk the Hulk.
In a night. And I do think
it's an
that this
entire
is,
life.
Yeah, that's an entire life. And I do think this is a problem that actually that assumption that smart people are Swiss Army knives of smartness where every tool they pull out is just going to be equally smart. I feel like you would expect that America's greatest doctor, the smartest doctor in America, would be just this brilliant guy who, like, you could throw a Rubik's Cube to him. That's something you see in movies a lot. Smart people, without any practice, can solve a Rubik's Cube in, like, seconds because they just see everything in three-dimensional. That's a kid's game. Like, that's a trick. It's like a party trick, learning how to solve the Rubik's Cube, and it's not a thing that takes particular intelligence, and neither is enjoying classical music. But Dr. Oz is actually like one of the smartest, most brilliant doctors in America. So he gets this TV show where he's trusted to expound on every single type of health concern. And the truth is, he's a heart surgeon. Like, he operates, like, he still performs surgery on people's hearts, and he's great at it and is still great at it, but that doesn't mean that he's good at telling you how you should change your diet if you're an overweight person who's addicted to, you know, sucrose in the Midwest. And he's done a lot of damage because people assume that that is the case. And like every book that hits the bestseller list that's like a celebrity of one sort giving you life advice about how you should change your life in this way that they, I think it's especially tempting for the people themselves to believe that their success is actually this Rosetta Stone that will work for everybody, that is kind of at the heart of how we think about smart people.
One of the most obnoxious quotes I see every month is, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. Albert Einstein. Okay, Albert Einstein is in no way an expert on insanity, mental health, or anything. Albert Einstein is not a wise philosopher who is just knows about life and how life works. He was an expert in a very specific particular field, and he became an expert because he studied it from a very young age and read a lot and spent a lot of time working at it. He is not an expert in economics or anything else.
Or bees dying off, as the M. Night Shyamalan movie The Happening had like a quote, once the bees go, humanity will follow 10 years later, that first of all is apocryphal. Einstein's the number one like source of bullshit quotes, but why would you even think that Einstein would know shit about bees or what will happen after the Third World War?
Yeah, you can't switch from normal oil to synthetic, Albert Einstein.
Yeah, and the quote about insanity is utter nonsense. There are lots of processes where repeating the same thing will in fact give you a better result just because conditions will change or whatever. There's lots of things that work that way.
The scientific method relies on it. Yes. And that was Einstein's main thing. That was his whole jam.
I thought he created the law of physics, right?
It was the law of
the
physics.
Three
yes.
laws.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jason.
The reason, like you said, he's the number one name to go to for these fake quotes. That's a perfect example. Because it's like if you stick Albert Einstein's name on it, like there's one about capitalism, like something about, I can't remember what it is, but like it's, this is like the end point of human economy or something. And they stick his name. It's like he was not an economist, but to the average person, you figure, well, if you're smart, you're smart. You're smart on everything. Just like Tony Stark, or just like, you know, the Robert Downey version Jr. of Sherlock Holmes, who in addition, because he's smart at analyzing crime scenes, is also an expert fighter. Because he, if you're smart at crime scenes, you're also smart at fighting. You're so smart that you know where to punch a guy. Doesn't that just follow?
You can stop time and have psychic debates about your fight with your nemesis, which is what happens at the end of the last movie when he begins, because the other guy can also foresee how a fight's going to go. So they're like arguing in their heads with each other.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. That's super cool. And I know there's nobody out there that thinks that's how fights actually work, but there are lots and lots and lots of people out there that think if you're smart and well-spoken, everything you say must be gold. Like there are entire cults that have come about this way, because if there's somebody that, you know, they just seem to know what they're talking about, people will just follow you to the ends of the earth based on this idea that, well, if you're smart, you're smart. You must know, you know, if you've got a PhD, then you must know how to fix my car. Or more specifically, you must know how to fix my relationship.
Just a quick thing about Einstein that I think is funny and kind of puts his super Yoda status into some relief is the fact that, like, once he got famous, he immediately just started having like tons of affairs and wrote his wife this note that was like, you should never talk to me if I don't want to be talked to. Cook me food, wash my clothes, and don't expect sex. And so she obviously divorced him immediately. And then he got engaged to his cousin, then had an affair with her 18-year-old daughter, and then spent the rest of his life like having all these torrid affairs and writing his cousin, who he was married to, really detailed descriptions about them. But I guarantee you, if there was like a Einstein guide to marriage, like what Einstein had to say about like how to make a marriage work, people would listen to that because he's Einstein and he knows all in our estimation. But he wasn't good at marriage, is what I'm saying. Those are things you shouldn't do.
No, it was... Well, it depends on how you define being good at marriage.
Right.
So let me ask, the people on this podcast right now that we're all in the same room for...
Jason's putting his hand on both of our hands, one hand on each.
Is there anyone here who has a negative stereotype about the group you're in that you know personally is untrue? and I'm going to take, before you two can speak, I'm going to take the idea that novelists, like, are all drunk fringe types, like that writers are by necessity somebody who has lived in their car for a while and has, you know, is just sort of on the fringes of whatever. Like, it's somebody who's, like, always on the verge of, like, having some sort of a breakdown or whatever. But most of the writers I know are pretty straightforward, level-headed guys and, like, work day jobs and have never been fired and have never... And, like, I've never had a drink in my life. That's something where, like, the famous examples of that are more exciting to read about. So those are the guys whose personal lives became, like, the subject of their public persona, where the ones who are just very, like, a Dean Koontz, somebody who's just a very workmanlike, cranks out books, works 70 hours a week, stays home with his dog and his wife, like... Nobody is going to read, like, an autobiography of his life because it's very boring. He just writes all the time. Whereas Hemingway, you know, led a fascinating life and, you know, also killed himself. And so that's suddenly sexier. But there's been quite a few people have been surprised at how completely uninteresting my personal life is, because they just assume in order to write, like, weird novels, you have to be, like, somewhat crazy.
Can I speculate on where that comes from? Because I do think throughout history, writers had a tendency to be more likely to have substance abuse problems and therefore be crazy, because those things are inextricably linked. But we like to think, you know, he had demons and so he drank and then shot himself and jumped out of a plane. I think we said that Hemingway did that at one point. But I really think it's that not having a 9-to-5 job and not having a boss who's breathing down your neck makes it easy to let yourself slide into bad habits. And so being a writer historically allows people to develop bad habits, and that's where that stereotype comes from. And I think more and more, like, as people are sort of figuring out that your diet and your ability to, like, eat nutritiously has a lot to do with how well you think and how well you write, that's going to be less and less the case, except for people who read all those biographies of people in the 40s and 50s who let themselves get away with that because, you know, that's the easy thing to do.
And Hunter S. Thompson is a great example, because though I'm sure he did do a lot of drugs and was a very clearly a magnetic, charming, charismatic person, when you read his accounts of his life and, like, accounts even people who are close to him, like, he's very much a character that he was building. And he was tapping into that, like, writer character that, like, oh, you know, we live these crazy lives, and that's a big part of what has made him a legend. Like the daily schedule of Hunter S. Thompson, where it's just cocaine, 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 drinking cocaine. It's like, no, I don't, yeah. I don't think so.
Yeah,
it doesn't sound realistic
no,
at all.
And I would bet that substance abuse issues and mental health issues, if that they're higher among writers. I'm talking about all writers. I'm talking about writers of, you know, nonfiction historical books. I'm talking about writers of TV shows, commercials, ad copy, people who write for a living. If the rate is higher among that group, I bet it is marginally higher. And I do bet that it's not lower than the general population. But I don't think you can consistently meet deadlines. I don't think you can consistently do research and turn it into finished product, you know, because especially like freelance writers, a lot of the ones who write for us have to be writing basically like 16 hours a day to pay the bills, because they've got, you know, 5 different publications they're cranking at work for, you know, just constantly reading, constantly absorbing things, hopping from project to project. For every one flamboyant guy who's out there, you know, drinking and making a big deal about how he lives an alternative lifestyle or whatever, I bet there's 50 or 100 that are just getting up early, you know, walking the dog, sitting down, cranking out that day's work, and kind of keeping their nose to the grindstone. It's just that the personalities of the ones that became famous train wrecks are so, they're such big personalities and they're so flamboyant that when you think of all the writers through history, you think, well, of course, there's Hunter S. Thompson and Kurt Vonnegut and da da da. It's like, yeah, but you're intentionally remembering the ones who had big personalities. You're not looking at a library where there's 5 million books there and realizing, oh, wait a second, these are probably not the result of 3 million addicts and you know, people who have bipolar disorder. You know, most of these people, you know, this person sat down and wrote this biography of Ben Franklin. They, in fact, were not smoking meth the whole time and on a motorcycle trip across the United States. It was somebody who was sitting down with the text and grinding through their research and just, you know, grinding it out. And it's the process of watching me write surreal horror is me sitting here, maybe like drinking coffee, and I'm writing that in one window. On the other window, I'm writing a very boring email to my editor about a spelling error I noticed. like that's it. And there's no, it's extremely disappointing when people meet me. It really is, because they expect something so much more exciting. And this is why I don't like to meet fans, because it's just, you can see the disappointment in their eyes immediately.
Well, they also think you're an Asian person, usually, I think, is...
Right. So anyway, do either of you have an equivalent, like, based on where you're from or anything?
I have a similar one. Like, since the Fast and Furious movies got so big, people assume that when you're in the underground street racing scene, it's just you have, like, all these cars at your disposal. And I've been maintaining the same 1970 Dodge Challenger for, like, 8 years, and you'll have like one girl in a bikini who starts the race, but it won't be like 40 just following you around rubbing. And when they get up on your, you know, on your car, that's obviously, it's not great for the suspension, and that's really important.
Now keep this going for like an hour.
You would never crash a car through two buildings.
You
like
could
that's
do
irresponsible
one.
You would crash through one. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I grew up as a coach's son who couldn't shoot worth a shit. I have the most broken jump shot you've ever seen, and my dad's a basketball coach. And the thing that coaches' sons are always supposed to be able to do is shoot really well. And like, there was even this time when I was playing, and I hated going to the free throw line, the same reason that like Dwight Howard hates going to the free throw line, except he has the excuse of having giant hands that make the ball like a softball in his hands, and so he, you know, it's hard to have any finesse. And I just had a really ugly shot, and I got fouled and like was going to the line, and I think the ref said, "Oh, you guys shouldn't foul this one. This guy's got a you never foul the coach's son, don't you guys know that?" I was like, that's weird that you're saying that, ref. But then I, like, bricked both of the creatures. It was so, just so mortifying. Yeah, so that would be mine. I'm probably too close to all the stereotypes I don't embody as an adult now that I no longer play in the NBA.
If people are having trouble separating fact from fiction, that part was not a wacky fake story Jack made up. His father coached in the NBA.
Yeah. Yeah, that comes off really lame after Sarge. I like had my personal anecdote that I was ready to tell and fucking Sarge.
But I knew this when I very first started working here in 2007. I knew somehow, I don't know how I found that, maybe Jay Pinkerton had told me, but I knew that at the time Jack's dad was coaching. Maybe he may have been with the Celtics at the time, Jack?
I don't remember, yeah.
Okay, it's a bit, it's the fact that you don't remember and that how sad that is ties into the story, because one of the very first things Jack told me, he was trying to get an article done, and he mentioned he was having trouble typing it because he had broken his finger, because someone had thrown him a basketball and he had caught it on the end of his finger, which... to this day was like the saddest thing anyone had ever had to admit to me.
Is that true?
Yeah. you were struggling to type because you had broken your middle finger trying to catch a basketball. And I was like, it had to have been so hard for you to admit to me, because the joke I had made you was like, when your dad sees you, what are you going to tell him you were doing instead?
Dunking.
Like, you're clearly not going to admit that just the act of someone tossing you a ball resulted in, because you didn't know. Like, that's how a little kid, you know, it's like a kid gets hit in the face with a baseball in the infield when he's trying to field it and he misses it with the glove. It's like, that's like the saddest injury you can have.
Jammed fingers are not that uncommon in basketball, but in that case, I was actually lying, and it was just picking up a basketball that was just on the ground, and I broke three of my fingers. Yeah, no, I'm not a good athlete, and I come from a line of good athletes, so that's probably why I work in comedy. Like, working in comedy, people are like, oh, this guy's fucked up, and also this guy's gonna be like a fucking barrel of laughs, like constantly on, and that's not my personality. Jason, you're a funny person in person, but you have a team of writers who's writing every time you come to appear before us.
Yeah, it is weird to hear Jason, you know, telling jokes and making observations that he was screaming at me to write just 2 hours ago.
Yeah, make it better. Make me funnier.
I'm thinking, well, I grew up in the Caribbean, but I'm thinking like there's got to be stereotypes about that, but they're
Sarge,
more or
your
less
life
true.
Is like so weird and interesting.
Because like my dad was a professional sailor, and he was like a really chill guy who seemed like he was like Captain Ron, if anyone's seen Captain Ron.
Yeah, but there's no stereotypes about what Captain Ron's kid is like.
Right. There are no stereotypes that encompass his life.
There are in fact a lot of one thing that's sort of funny about the Caribbean that people may not realize is that like the Rastas are sort of outsiders in the community and the locals and in a lot of the towns.
Oh, really? Like yeah. It's not a Rasta town. Like an establishing shot of the Caribbean is like someone playing steel drum and smoking a spliff, and like that's actually.
Yeah, no, they play steel drums like for the tourists, but all the Rastas I knew sold fresh fruit and vegetables at market, but they were, you know, they came over from a different island with their stuff to sell it. And then I remember seeing once, I forget where I was, I think I was maybe in St. Martin, but there was a local sitcom that came on, and the premise of the episode was that the daughter in the family had brought home a Rasta boyfriend, and her parents were so horrified because there's like, oh, it's dating a Rasta, and he sounded like a character from Cool Runnings, the crazy Rasta guy, and the parents like, oh no, our daughter. And he's like, what up, man? Like doing a fake, like a Caribbean
guy. Oh, like
guy
saying
man
and
Caribbean.
All that is like not. Do they speak like
they,
more the King's English?
No, there is. They definitely have their dialect and it is distinct. But yeah, again, I think I might be a little too close and I'm not sure what the stereotypes are exactly. There is a lot of pot smoking down there. Like yeah. People do hang out on the beach and relax a lot.
Yeah, what are the normal people like? You're like, yeah, I mean, they smoke pot and they
and
hang out on the beach.
Sell market outside. And sell fresh fruit
they vegetables say, what are you bringing us this Rasta man for? It's not really blowing me away.
Sorry. Sorry, my life isn't interesting enough for you, Jay.
Get the fuck out of here, sir.
Well, but that's, you guys just touched on another one, and this may not apply to anybody on the call, but the stereotype that anybody who smokes marijuana is someone who just hangs out on the couch all day or on the beach, or they're just a total dropout in society, or if they have a job, then it's like on Workaholics where they just work enough that they can finally get home and hit the bong or whatever. And the fact that in real life, like I would say probably most heroin addicts have jobs and are productive members of society. Like if you're listening to this, please don't start doing heroin. Please.
Those are the ones who can manage it without killing themselves.
I think
it, like,
marijuana is more people with productive jobs and ambitious who smoke marijuana might be a little bit more common than
well now everybody
heroin.
Smokes marijuana so.
No but in it's that's more common, but I'm saying that statistically most people that do methamphetamine also manage their lives. They smoke meth, they go to work, they work a job, they come home, and the percentage of people who become train wrecks, you know, it's just like most smokers don't get lung cancer. It's like 30%. That doesn't mean you should start smoking. 30% is a terrifying rate. And the percentage of methamphetamine addicts that do get their lives totally derailed is terrifyingly high. But it's not most of them. And this is like in the whichever Malcolm Gladwell book that you got from me, Jack, he mentions this. Like the rate of people that do cocaine and actually become addicts is pretty small. Like the addiction rate is not 100% or 90% or 85%. It's small. Most people who try it a few times, they do it at parties and they're fine. But you don't tell people that because obviously we don't want anyone listening to this think, oh, okay, well, good. Yeah, I'll start doing the cocaine tomorrow. Thank you, podcast, for telling me how to live my life. And that's not the point. The point is that what happens is when you finally meet somebody who is able to keep their life together while smoking pot or while smoking meth or while doing heroin or while doing whatever, it kind of shatters your idea of what society has told you because the stereotype is if you touch this stuff, you are a stoner. Or you are a burnout. You're going to be in a ditch, in an alley. You're going to be blowing strangers for drug money. And when you meet somebody who kind of has their life together, despite having an addiction on the side. It's like, well, so that was all lies, right?
Yeah, I think an interesting kind of side note to that is that people who drink heavily and end up sort of having a problem is probably similar in percentage to the people who do some of those other drugs that you're talking about and end up having a problem. But that's not something that you really see. Like, everybody on TV is a social drinker and their lives aren't falling apart. And cigarettes, I guess now if you see someone, a character smoke, you expect that they'll get cancer at some point. But it does seem like only Quentin Tarantino movies make room for the social use of other drugs that we were afraid of in the 80s, and like 99.9% make room for just kind of social drinking without your life going off the rails.
And it's funny how that's changed too, because if you watch old movie The Thin Man, the first in the Thin Man series, the Nick and Nora, the husband and wife detective team, in the first movie, every single scene they're knocking back highballs. And they would be dead if they were really drinking that much. And then as the series went on in the sequels, that was when people started to realize you can't drink like that. And the amount they drink declines sharply in the sequels, if I'm remembering correctly.
Like the Hangover movies were one of the most successful out of nowhere comedies in a long time. And they show people drinking incredibly irresponsibly and having like their lives drastically affected, but then no changes are made and it's just treated as like fun. And then like Mad Men, like it started out really popular and then the ratings like slowly declined. And I feel like that was happening as the consequences of his alcoholism like became a thing. And like the movies that show actual like problems with alcohol are always like really unpopular art films, I feel like. Whereas
Leaving Las Vegas isn't a that wasn't a huge hit.
It won an Oscar, but that's a good point. That was the 90s.
I was
man.
Being sarcastic.
Everyone
I thought that movie didn't
heroin.
Do that well. But we have touched on one of my favorite things, which is old depictions of drugs that are hilarious. There's a I put it on Twitter a while ago, but there's a clip from Dragnet where Jack Webb is talking about alcohol, like someone tells a detective in this old 60s detective show, and someone says, "Hey man, you know, marijuana isn't as bad as alcohol," and he just goes off on the speech about how marijuana leads to heroin, which leads to LSD, which will kill you. And it's just this insane rant that has, like, this old understanding of how drugs works. The metaphor is marijuana is the spark, heroin is the fuse, and LSD is the bomb. I really like it. That's all. I don't have a point to make about
it. Well, yeah,
it.
But funny. No, but this ties into exactly what we're talking about, is the person who wrote that thought they were doing something good by creating a stereotype that they thought would help people, which is the stereotype of somebody that tries a drug and then gets sucked into the black pit of despair of harder drugs. And that stereotype, that portrayal hung around pop culture for like half a century. Like, that used to be standard. Like, that cautionary tale, you know, less than zero, all the way, you know, up through the 80s with the cocaine boom. Like, that was out there, that New Jack City with crack. Like, that was out there for a long, long time. That was totally a stereotype and what they would have thought of as a harmless stereotype. Because, after all, what's the harm in trying to scare people away from doing drugs?
Something that I don't think is really historically remembered now, because the 80s like did such a hard correct, was that Jimmy Carter's Drug Czar came out and was like, cocaine is good for you, essentially. He was like, of all the illicit drugs, cocaine is not habit forming. Right up to the beginning of the 80s, it was believed that cocaine was not addictive, even among like public health officials. And then the 80s hit and suddenly there were problems. And then they did a hard correct. But it's interesting. I had no idea that that was a thing that was like publicly out there, that the guy who was in charge of drugs was like, hey, man, makes you more effective and, you know, of all the illegal drugs, not so bad. So
makes sex better?
Yeah, exactly.
It's great.
I had some just the other day.
Yeah, the history of drug law and the government's approach to drugs in this country is kind of a comedy of errors.
If there's something like a final thought here, I just want to emphasize this is not supposed to be like a political point. it just has to do with the people you meet every day, having expectations for them that are sort of based on these very lazy things only makes their life worse, even if the thing that you're referring to seems kind of silly or seems like just kind of you're ribbing them about it and it's just sort of a fun thing. Like, well, everybody knows that Asians are supposed to be good at math. Like, there's a chance that they're not going to care. But there's a reason we keep bringing these up on the site, is because the more you stop and make yourself think, okay, is this a real thing or is this just some dumb story that we've decided to start telling ourselves about these people, the better off you are just in terms of dealing with people and not expecting the gay guy to have a super clean apartment or whatever, however innocuous the thing is. That it's not about trying to be politically correct or anything like that. It's just about being better at dealing with people, because ultimately there's nobody that perfectly conforms to whatever the stereotype is, whether it's for a race or a job or from a part of the country. So you're just better off kind of assuming that they don't apply to the person you're talking to. That if you, once you start trying to do that, or like really being conscious of it, you find out you do this daily. Like, it's really hard to stop. It's really hard.
Yeah. And I think if there's any complaint, because like I said, I think it's really interesting, really revealing to see what assumptions the people who make movies and the people who go to see those movies make about people and types of people. And it would just be more interesting to see what different types of people, because so many movies are directed by white males. Like, I think we now have it pretty down what white males think about people who aren't white males. I'd be interested to see what more black males, black women, gay women, how they see the world, and like see the world from their perspective, where white males only show up to be like, bonfire, and then surf away. Right. That was our conversation. Hope you enjoyed it. On the footnotes, we opened with David Guetta, Nicki Minaj collabo, Hey Mama, which felt appropriate because Pitch Perfect 2 came out recently and I haven't seen it, but that first movie talked about him a lot, and now I'm hearing the song everywhere and it's pretty dope, and I think it's pretty clear how it relates to what we were talking about this week, in that it doesn't relate to it at all. Same goes for the song we wrote into and out of the ads on Margarita by Mas Yassa, M-A-S, and then Y-S-A. Man, these are all songs that would have been more appropriate to the last episode where I talked about mothers being underrated, because Margarita is apparently Thomas Arsenault's mom's name. That's the musician who goes by Mas Yassa, and it's the first single he's released off his debut full-length album. He's a guy from Brooklyn, and I don't know, he's distilled some like extract of what made certain 80s music good that I didn't know could be extracted. So good on ya, Mas Yassa. And we're gonna ride out on a song called Forgiveness by Made in Heights. They've been all over the Hype Machine app for the past few weeks, and this is another sort of 80s extract song that I can't stop listening to. So yeah, I hope you enjoy it. That's Forgiveness. Artist is Made in Heights. That's M-A-D-E in H-E-I-G-H-T-S, I believe. But definitely not Made in Lake Voyage. Thanks for listening. We could use some reviews on iTunes. That helps people find us, drives us up the charts with a bullet, or whatever people used to say. So yeah, if you enjoyed this show or other shows, let iTunes know. And we'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you then, guys. Turn the page and you hear the bass over.
easy to confuse the way I speak with how I move. I'm not trying, babe, not giving up. Won't simplify my ways till you make the cut. What can I say when you dance on in with your cools and your fools and your friends, rolling like you're king of the skies? Well, I got one more chance to show you how round we go when the lights are low and the circus fades. You were always carouseling all the circles trace as I turn.
Guys, thanks for hanging around for the whole song. I'm glad you liked that song. I'm here to remind you that today's episode was brought to you by Lynda.com. If you want to be a better photographer, they've got classes on how to do that. If you want to make your website better, you can learn how at Lynda.com. Whether it's learning how to code, how to do graphic design, no matter what you're looking for, they've probably got a course on it. So go to Lynda.com/cracked today. That's Lynda.com/cracked. For a 10-day free trial. Thanks for listening, and thanks, Lynda.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio, boom.com. Oh, oh, oh. The wolf dead.